Jim, thank you for the invitation, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today. It's a great honor to be associated with Gordon in some way. That was a tremendous experience in my life to be working with him. Conversations with Gordon, they weren't like lectures. They were more like question sessions. He didn't do much talking. He mostly asked questions. Some of the hardest questions that you can imagine. And I saw many graduate students wilt when Gordon would clear his throat at the end of a lecture. Maybe that's not why we're here. I think one of the most unique things about Gordon was, in spite of the fact that there's no doubt in my mind that he was a world-class scientist in every respect. He was one of the most humble men that I ever met. And when you went to his house to be one of his children and sit around Myra's table, he didn't talk shop, he talked family, and that was what was important to him then. That meant a lot to me. He was a genuine person, a genuine man that cared about other people. When we think about Gordon, I think there's some things you ought to consider. One is, in Montana, Lewis and Clark's a big deal. We're coming on the bicentennial of the Lewis and Clark expedition, and they also went through Nebraska. And when I think of...
They had to
go through Nebraska, yeah. So when I think of Lewis and Clark, I think of pioneers. When I think of Nebraska, I think of wagon trains having to go across this state on their pioneer's way to Oregon and places like that. And just like a wagon train had to have a scout to kind of lead the way and find a place to camp, in some ways, Gordon was kind of that way. As a scientist, he was sort of a scout that was willing to look at areas long before other people were ready to think about them. And he kind of looked at those places to camp long before the industry was ready to be there. Even though this is a symposium about beef cattle and this is a Beef Improvement Federation meeting, I think it's important that you understand that beef cattle was just one piece of Gordon's work. But Gordon spent a significant amount of his career dealing with chickens. He had many graduate students working on problems in the sheep industry, and he also had a few, like myself, that worked in pigs. When I left Montana State as a graduate student, I did my master's at Montana State. I remember my advisor there, Don Kress, telling me, well, if you go to Nebraska, do anything but work on a model. He says he didn't think that was the right thing to do. And I had my heart set on working on a sheep problem when I got to Nebraska, and I was really disappointed that I didn't get that sheep project. And even more disappointed when Gordon gave me the modeling project, because I'd been advised that was not what I should do. But maybe a little bit like Jim, he sat me down and convinced me that that's what I should do. And he was good at that. So what I'll do, my talk is a little bit more historical about Gordon, and I hope that's okay. But it's organized in these pieces, which reflect some of the work that Gordon did in relationship to beef cattle. If you would stack all of Gordon's papers up and start from the beginning in reading, you'd soon come on a term called biological objectives. And this was a term that Gordon used over and over again. And I won't read that to you. You can read it yourself. But this is his definition of biological objective. But it had to do with the economic effect of traits on production systems. In Gordon's view, he thought that biological objectives should be the basis of most management decisions in a production enterprise, including genetic decisions. He felt like that the geneticists as a whole, or the research industry, if you will, had spent a tremendous amount of effort trying to determine how fast we could go somewhere, but not very much emphasis on which way we should go. We've worked a lot on improving ways of improving or increasing the rate of genetic change, but spent a lot less time on deciding which way to go. And that was sort of a pet peeve of Gordon's, at least when I was his student. And I suspect that same comment would still be valid today. We spend way more research time worrying about how fast to get someplace rather than which way we should go. But he saw biological objectives as a way of making management decisions. He thought they should be geared towards the future, that we should look ahead to where production systems might be in the future rather than where they are today, and that certainly genotype-environment interactions ought to be part of that equation. As Dave mentioned in his talk, it's difficult to separate economic and biological efficiency. If we let biological mean inputs like feed and outputs like weight or lean tissue or whatever, those things are really only important because they cost something. There's a lot of water that goes into a lot of production systems, but we seldom measure that in genetic studies. And the reason we don't is because it doesn't cost very much. And so I think if Gordon were here, he would argue that the things that are important are always economic. And the things that we measure and choose to select for or change are things that have some economic impact. And some things that would not be considered biological that are important in production systems that are very real include non-feed costs and the fact that when we only look at biological inputs, Gordon would argue that those things don't all cost the same. The energy that you provide a beef cow in a range environment is certainly not as expensive on a per unit basis, per pound basis, as the energy you provide to a steer in a feedlot. And biological measures alone don't account for that. Similarly, the outputs from a production system are not all equally valuable. The outputs from a young steer at slaughter age is certainly more valuable per unit of weight than that of a cull cow, but yet in Montana I suspect that cull cows provide about 20% of the income for most of our ranchers. So some measure of economic efficiency that allows these things to be taken into account are important. In Gordon's paper, one of the things that were common for him to say was that efficiency was what we should focus on and that profit was not so important. In his mind, he thought profit was, quote, an illusory criteria, that profit margins tend to hover near zero in a competitive system, and that wasn't nearly as important as reducing the cost of per unit of value produced. I think one of Gordon's biggest contributions to genetics was that he was one of the first geneticists that really understood production systems or spent a lot of time looking at the way production systems work. He understood that the way we produce animals in this country are systems that are dynamic, systems that are very interactive, and that a change in one point of the system could affect performance at another point in the system as well. And so even though he had a great ability to look and dissect a problem down to its smallest components, he never lost sight of the bigger picture, and I think that was one of the things that made his contributions so valuable. If you look at his publication record, I think you'd be impressed by how many different kinds of scientists Gordon published with. Gordon worked with scientists from all of these disciplines and maybe more that I'm not aware of. I think in my PhD program alone, I worked directly with representatives from all but one of these disciplines. And that was something that Gordon, I think, contributed to. That he appreciated the work of other branches of science, and he incorporated those directly into his work. He also worked with different species, as I mentioned before. And we really can't divorce that from Gordon. We can't make him a beef cattle geneticist, because that's not what he was. He was a geneticist that worked with lots of different species. And I don't have the original data to reproduce his slides, but he had slides like this in several of his papers where he would evaluate different aspects of efficiency for different species. And like Dave illustrated, his slides were much more glamorous than mine. And I can remember how he made some of those slides. When I was a grad student, that was long before PowerPoints. And I think they called those slides diazo slides, didn't they? They were on a black background and the white lettering. And he thought that was a little bit bland. And so Gordon would sit there in his office with colored pens and hold those slides up to the light and color over that white to get the color there. And he took a lot of kidding for his slides. Another characteristic of Gordon's early work was his use of what I would consider rather complex but single equation models of production systems. And this is sort of a composite of several different papers where each of these variables in there represents different components of a production system, either describing how inputs enter the system or outputs exit the system. The papers that he published and wrote about and spoke about in the early 70s on through the early 80s were largely the product of equations like this. What's interesting to me is that Gordon, to my knowledge, didn't become computer literate until the very end of his career. And all these papers that were written in those years were done by hand at most on a calculator. And thousands and thousands of calculations done by hand. In spite of his limitations in using computers himself, he was one of the most prolific, I guess, users of systems analysis and computer models when that came around in the mid and late 70s. He was largely influenced by people like Tom Cartwright at Texas A&M, and maybe didn't develop as many models as some others, but certainly his students and collaborators used models more frequently and probably resulted in more publications than just about any other place. Each of these papers cited here represents one in a series. And he worked, again, in beef cattle, swine, and sheep. And I think the use of different species and the comparisons of across those species gave him insights that some of the rest of us that today work in maybe just beef cattle alone sometimes miss. If you look at his work, I think, at just in beef cattle, there's probably four traits or four major areas of performance that he's devoted some portion of his time or a major portion of his time, and I'd like to talk about each of those a little bit. He wrote some papers about the effects of growth rate and mature size on efficiency. And in Gordon's mind, when you talked about growth rate, you talked about mature size at the same time. And that was he was not unique in that respect. Many of the computer simulation models essentially treat growth rate as a byproduct of mature size. And I think he was comfortable with that. But he also realized that there was lots of trade-offs involved in selection for growth, that bigger cattle had some positives and some negatives. That faster growing cattle did reduce post-weaning maintenance requirements, especially if they were put on a per unit of gain basis. But they also had some negatives associated with increased mature size, age of puberty, and some reproductive problems as well. Maybe most importantly, it seems to me that Gordon saw that selection for growth rate allowed production systems to market animals at heavier weights without penalties due to changes in body composition. And if you think about where the beef industry today, what's the biggest change in the beef industry in the last 20 years? We've changed efficiency in terms of the amount of product produced per cow, but a great deal of that is we've changed the harvest weight on the cattle. And that's changing rapidly every year yet today. And that selection for growth is probably, or the replacement or substitution of animals that are from faster growing breeds has allowed this to occur. He was one of the first. I'm not sure that he was the first. I'm not that good a historian, but certainly one of the first people to talk about bending the growth curve, and Dave mentioned that before. And it was in that light that he came up with what many people refer to the Dickerson Index. It was a paper he wrote in 1974 based upon some actual data collected on post-weaning feedlot conditions of animals. And the target of his index was the value of marbling-adjusted boneless retail cuts minus feedlot costs. Those were actually measured. And then he also adjusted this for the net effects of selection for growth on mortality, reproduction, and cow size. He came up with a selection index, which I've heard referred to many times as the Dickerson Index. yearling weight minus 3.2 birth weight. There was also an even, quote, better index in that paper that seldom gets mentioned, where he added back fat to the equation. But he showed in this paper that by using a selection index for yearling weight adjusted for birth weight there, that compared to selection for yearling weight alone, that birth weight would only increase by 44% as much. You get 91 and 90% of the increase in weaning weight and yearling weight, and only 73% of the increase in mature weight, and about a 6% improvement in efficiency defined in the way he defined it here. Body composition. I think Gordon had a real fascination for the whole idea of body composition. First, he saw that as the correct, that output really needed to be measured in terms of some sense of body composition, that just weight alone was too simple, that the value of the weight needed to be accounted for in the fatness of the marbling or whatever. And that many of his papers spoke of a value-based pricing system. And this is probably 20 years ahead of the time in which we had actual grid marketing, but many of Gordon's papers could have easily been phrased in that sort of light. So he was sort of ahead of his time, I think, in that respect. He also spent a great deal of his time working on the effects of differences in body composition on input costs and production systems. We might think of Gordon as a great geneticist, and certainly he was. But he also was the spark plug of the ideas behind lots of experiments conducted at Clay Center and other places that dealt with some pretty fundamental issues of nutrition and physiology. It was his students and collaborators at Clay Center that looked at the effects of body composition on maintenance requirements. It was his students that looked at the effect of the energetic cost of protein deposition is different from that of fat deposition in livestock, and even had some simulated production systems that accounted for the differences in body composition on the type of feeds needed to supply the growth requirements of different animals. Milk production. Several of his papers, most notably Dave's Nodder's thesis, dealt with the effects of milk production on economic efficiency. I suspect of the different traits, this received less emphasis, in my opinion, in Gordon's subsequent work, mainly because Gordon saw production systems as integrated all the way from conception to slaughter, and he seldom dealt with just weaning systems. This is copied from Dave's thesis supplied by Dave just a few days ago, but it shows the effect of milk potential on the cost of production and for different mature sizes, so that as cows got larger, they could tolerate a little more milk production and still be efficient. But maybe the most important aspect of Dave's work to me was that he showed that for different mature sizes, there was sort of a potential optimum for milk production. On this slide, I don't have a pointer that I can see that very well, but the solid line in the graph stands for number weaned or weaning rate, which the scale is on the left. The right-hand scale is weight weaned per cow exposed. And you can see that both of those graphs peak in there, and between those peaks is where Dave defined the potential optimum milk yield. Now, this picture is going to be very similar to the one I'm going to show you next. This picture was from what Dave referred to as his base environment. But if he looked at an environment that was a harsher environment in terms of nutrient availability and quality, notice those graphs shrink quite a bit. That the optimum milk yield was smaller or lower and over a narrow range. His conclusions were that in a Midwestern environment that milk production's effect on efficiency, that milk efficiency was relatively insensitive to milk level in that environment, that efficiency did decrease if calf survival was decreased by not enough milk, or if milk got to such levels that it decreased the weight weaned per cow exposed because of the negative effects on reproduction. It was also sensitive to the relative price of feed inputs given to cows or calves. Now, in some work that that I've done at Montana State University trying to model western range environments. This graph shows you the simulated effects of increasing milk potential and rather average cows under Montana, eastern Montana range conditions. The magenta colored line, the pink line, is a line where at the same time we increased the genetic level for milk production, we also fed the cows according to body composition. Where the darker blue line is where we did not change the nutrient management of the cow herd at all as milk level increased. You can see that when we fed the cows more or fed them in proportion to their needs, kept the body composition the same, that weaning weight did go up. But if we didn't feed the cows according to their needs, the average weaning weight of the herd really didn't increase very much, and that's because the reproductive performance of the cow herd suffered so bad. That as you're increasing milk production and not changing your management at the same time, that cows are exiting the herd earlier, more of them are exiting, and so the average age of the cow herd is lower, the average calving date is getting later, and that sort of thing, and so the net benefit is not very very good. When we look at the effects on gross margin, which is a measure of profit, this is accounting for all the variable costs in a livestock enterprise of a fixed resource base, that when we increased milk production and kept the nutrient management system the same, that gross margin actually declined and declined quite a bit. If we fed the cows according to their needs, then it was sort of a push, that there was actually a small decline in profit, but it was relatively flat. So I would suggest that for milk production, there needs to be a balance struck between productivity and the resource availability and cost. The importance of milk production in integrated systems is probably a lot less than we think it is, and that when, as retained ownership is added to more and more operations, the importance of having heavy weaning weights is probably less and less. And that certainly selection for milk production will not be profitable in all systems. If you look at the genetic trends for the breeds, as I've borrowed this data out of sire summaries and whatnot for a few of the breeds that I could get on one slide, I've adjusted them to a 1988 base, so from that time forward. These are the genetic trends for milk production. I'm not sure this is the direction that cows need to go in Montana. And I'm not sure that in Montana we know whether we've changed the management system or how much we've changed the management system over the years as we've selected for bigger, heavier milking cows. My guess is that Montana cows are fed a whole lot better today than they were 20 years ago. They're given a lot more to eat and a lot more supplement. And that the net benefit of that may be very small. We actually may be going in the wrong direction. Reproductive rate. Dave did a good job of talking about that. This is a disadvantage of following, you know, being second in line, but reproductive rate was one of Gordon's favorite topics. And his across-species comparisons, I think, taught Gordon that this is where beef cattle need to catch up, is that compared to other species, beef cattle have a high female cost. The cost of maintaining reproductive age females is high relative to other species, and the reproductive rate is low. So probably the most sensitive area of a production system in terms of efficiency would be to some way increase reproductive rate. We need to get more output per cow. We need to spread out the cost of maintaining the cow over more output. And as Dave mentioned, it was early in, you know, 20 years ago that Gordon began talking about selection for twinning rate. This was not a popular topic then, I don't imagine, and it's not a popular topic today. But Gordon was not blind when he talked about these things. If you read his papers, he fully recognized the risks associated with selecting for reproductive rate in cattle, and he fully realized that that cows that twinned would take different kinds of management and different kinds of nutrition. In the paper by Guerrero Martinez, which was a graduate student of Gordon's, they looked at performance of cows that were induced to twin versus single cows, contemporaries, that certainly feed costs and non-feed costs were much greater, 36% greater for total cost, but they also produced nearly 80% more output. When we put that on an efficiency basis, dollars per kilogram, that feed costs reduced by 26%, non-feed costs by 20%, and total cost by about 24%. So there is certainly some potential there. Whether twinning is really an answer for American beef production systems, you know, that's still in question. I'm not sure I'm ready to go out to our producers in Montana and suggest that. I'm not sure that I would. But this is an example of Gordon thinking outside the box. 20 years ahead of when other people were willing to do that. And it's that same kind of thinking, I think, that is needed to address some of the dynamics, if you will, of the beef industry we see today. The industry is changing faster than most of us can keep up with it. It takes a digital Rolodex to keep track of company names. And the pace of change is going to only get worse, I suppose. And so it'll be those people that are willing to think out of the box and take some risks and do things in a different way that are likely to succeed. Mating systems. I suppose one of the standard fares of almost any graduate education in this country in genetics includes some of Gordon's papers on inbreeding and heterosis and the use of breed resources. Those papers were written 30 years ago, but they're as relevant today as they were at the time. And certainly Gordon, as Dave mentioned, firmly believed that commercial production systems needed to exploit the value of heterosis. And that was shown in several of his papers. Again, from Dave's thesis, this shows the rankings of some of the crossbreeding systems or mating systems that he studied in his dissertation work in terms of production costs for 100 kilograms of empty body weight. If the purebred is listed over there on the right, that he shows that certainly taking advantage of individual and maternal heterosis was extremely important. And in combining the idea of terminal crosses, which would be represented on the bars on the right-hand side, add further benefits as well. And a subsequent paper published in 1992 showed that the lifetime input cost per unit of output value could be reduced by 12% if crossbred cows and crossbred calves were used in the same production system. This same level of change has been demonstrated in work that one of my graduate students did, Margaret Lamb. Using data from Clay Center, she modeled integrated production systems where animals were sold on a grid kind of a system and showed again that even rotational crossbreeding had a tremendous opportunity to improve production efficiency and reduce cost. Casey Davis at Montana State showed that just maternal heterosis alone could be worth as much as $70 per cow exposed per year. And what kind of bothers me with all this kind of evidence is that you see that one breed in this country is increasingly dominant in terms of the number of registration. Montana is a pretty black state. And I wonder and worry, I guess, that the message of heterosis is somehow being lost chasing carcass traits, and that we're really not reminding producers that heterosis still works. One thing that Dave talked about was feed intake, and I would like to echo especially the early simulation models didn't do a very good job of predicting forage intake. And I think probably today that we could still probably have to confess that we don't know a lot about why cows eat what they do. What makes a cow stop eating? That's probably still largely unknown. But I can tell you that from working on beef production systems and trying to model those systems for nearly 20 years, that to take away the cow's ability to eat low-quality forage is one of the most dangerous things we can do to a beef production system in the West. And that whatever we would do to reduce our ability to eat those low-quality forages in great amounts, we risk ruining the system. there's a lot of interest today in changing calving seasons or looking at differences in calving seasons. And one of the motivations for that is to try to better match the forage supply or the forage quality, if you will, to the forage requirements of the cow. If we let the light-colored box represent the forage supplied or the quality of the forage supplied in a year, and let the red box be the requirements of the cow. Early spring calving, we have sort of a mismatch early that we're having to supply those cows need before there's green grass that she can harvest herself. When we moved to early summer calving, we've shifted the boxes a little bit, but now the problem is at the other end. And then in Montana, when forage matures about this time of the year and goes dormant, then though there might be a lot of standing grass out there, the quality of that forage is not nearly as good as it is in the springtime, and the cow's ability to eat enough of it to get by are a problem. When we go to fall calving, we even have an even more severe mismatch there. So I think when we look at some of these questions, we need to consider those things as well as how those animals will be managed and marketed. And I'll show you some results from a graduate student who finished her work just the last year at Montana State, looking at the effects of different calving seasons and different ways of marketing the calves. And I'll just use this as a way of illustrating the effect, how important it is to consider the whole production system and how you market the animals. One of the motivations for changing calving season is to exploit within-year price cycles in the beef industry. And this graph illustrates how those cycles tend to be. There's also across-year cycles were related to the national cow inventory, which we call the cattle cycle. And that's another fact of life that's part of the beef business. What Vicki did in her thesis was to simulate different kinds of calving seasons, or early spring, early summer, and fall calving seasons, with different kinds of marketing alternatives for the calves. And I'm not going to take your time to show you all the different kinds of scenarios that she looked at, but I'll just look at two of them here. One that I've labeled number one, which is selling calves off the cow at weaning time, and the other is putting the calves directly into a feedlot and selling them at slaughter weight. She looked at doing this at four different points in the cattle cycle, at the cycle high, the cycle low in terms of price, and in the two transition periods. And this is an example of some of the results she had. The sort of greenish-blue bar represents spring calving, the pink bar represents summer calving, and the yellow is fall calving at the four different stages of the cattle cycle. We used the 1990s cattle cycle and used an inflation-adjusted price to price these animals coming out of there. The spring calving cows wean their calves at about 7 months of age. The summer calving cows about 6.5, and the fall calving cows at about 5.5 months of age, which is like the people in Montana that are doing this. We kind of try to follow their example. The axis on the left is gross margin, which is like I tried to define to you earlier. It's for a fixed size of a ranch that has a certain amount of forage that can be harvested or produced for hay, then how much can be harvested off that ranch in terms of gross returns minus variable cost. And you can see that at all points in the cattle cycle, the spring calving cows won the race if you sold the calves at weaning. Now, this is when we take the calves, the heifers that are not used as replacements, and the steers, calves, and ship them to a custom feedlot and feed them to a slaughter weight, and then sell them. And you can see that the ranks of the systems change a little bit, and they're not the same at all points of the cattle cycle. When we look at just the change from this picture to this one, we're just going to subtract this one from that one, it looks like this. This is essentially the profit or loss from the retained ownership enterprise, which is, in Mike's opinion, that's the way you ought to treat retained ownership, as a separate enterprise, separate piece of your business. And you can see that again, the results are not consistent at all points in the life cycle, or cattle cycle, excuse me. The only consistent thing is that we found is if you have fall calving cows, you need to hold ownership on the calves. But if you have spring calving cows, that's not always the best option. And to make comparisons of calving systems or season of calving needs to consider these kinds of things. And I think this is just sort of representative of how I tend to view beef production systems. Another point that I think is important when we talk about economic efficiency is what sort of units we use. Gordon was a great fan of dollars per unit of output, dollar per kilogram. And for by and large, that unit, I think, ranks systems very well and very much the same as you would rank them with some measure of profit. But we need to think about where the profit's measured. Is it dollars per cow or dollar per acre? I think in Montana that it's more likely that the constraint that most of our producers face are acres and not cows. They have a certain resource base that they're trying to make a living off of, and that's their constraint. The opportunity to go buy more land in the short term is quite limited. This is data from another graduate student of mine who looked at changing the calving date within a season. These are smaller changes in calving date, but also looked at different dates of weaning and length of grazing time. So range removal date is the time when the cattle came off native range. So if you just look at the general trend of, say, that top line there, that would be for a weaning date of October the 6th, that as you extended the grazing season for the cows, the average herd size had to go down. In other words, if you have a certain resource of grass, you can graze that in 5 months with a few cows, or with a certain number of cows, or in 7 months with a lot less cows. Okay? So if you change the time that you had the cows out on native range, and at the same time change the time when you start supplemental feeding, like feeding hay, that if you extend the grazing period, the number of cows that you can manage on a fixed resource has to go down. The reason those lines aren't parallel is because the weaning dates are changing, and so that the difference in the lines at the right-hand side reflects the feed that the calves are eating. Now, this is the same interaction, if you will, but showing the effect on gross margin. It showed that for a fixed resource base, even letting herd size go down was more profitable if you graze the cows longer. And so profit per cow is not the measure here. It's not the measure. We live in a changing time. The beef industry is an extremely dynamic industry. I'm certainly not clairvoyant about what the future is going to be like. But I think the wisest thing for me as a geneticist, if you'll let me be that role, is that we need to encourage folks to look at genetic management from a systems approach. That it's fine to think about feed efficiency, but if we let that be the single trait that we're worried about, we're going down the wrong road that we've been down with other traits. That it's okay to look at that, but we can't divorce that from the production system as a whole. And we need to think about how cows perform back on the ranch, how the calves perform in the background lot or the feedlot, and how they hang on the rail. And we need to realize that genetics is just one piece of the pie of all the things I've got listed on the right-hand side. That genetics is one of the less frequently thought of management decisions that most cattle ranchers deal with. We're coming into a time where information is flowing a little more easily from the consumer back to the cow-calf producer, and that's certainly providing some incentives for genetic change in carcass traits, but we still need to remember the whole picture. We still have the same basic tools that we've always had in genetics. We can make choices among breeds, we can change the way those breeds are combined, and we can decide which animals to be parents. And when I teach undergraduates, I talk about having a toolbox. Those are the tools in that toolbox. But that's not the only toolbox a ranch manager has. Genetics is just one of those drawers. And it's not always the most important drawer. And for things, I usually tell students, if you can fix it any other way except genetics, that's what you ought to do. That's, it's quicker and maybe less expensive. but we need to recognize that. And genetics needs to fit within the management systems of everything else. It needs to be practical. And so if anything I can leave you with of value, this is what Mike believes, is that we need to package our genetic management in a system that recognizes all the pieces of the cow-calf production system. And to focus only on one end or the other is to miss the target. We can have great cattle that gives us $30 premium on a grid, but they could easily lose that $30 in the feedlot. And if the cows can't reproduce at home, then that's not very good either. In closing, I'd like to read this quote from Gordon that was in a paper he wrote in 1986. "Perhaps we should not be too critical of the emphasis placed by earlier breeders on pleasing color patterns, horns, and beauty of conformation. Such intangible aesthetic rewards for the breeder's efforts are not as easily snatched away by the unfeeding laws of supply and demand, as are the returns from increased efficiency of production. However, to the extent that our role is to help reduce costs of animal products to consumers, we do need to focus on those genetic changes in form and function that are most relevant." Thank you for your attention, and it's been an honor to be here, and Myra, thank you for making us part of your life.